Other middle-aged men have brought young women to the fantasy suite for activities not unlike Wilson's. But ordinarily, there is something a bit desperate and tawdry about such aging pleasure-seekers. It's unlikely that any of them would be able to talk about their debauchery in such a way that it would sound almost fresh and innocent. Charlie Wilson, however, had a genius for getting people to judge him not as a middle-aged scoundrel, but instead as if he were a good-hearted adolescent, guilty of little more than youthful excess. This survival skill permitted him to routinely do things that no one else in Congress could have gotten away with. One of the first to marvel at this unique capacity to openly flaunt the rules was the young Diane Sawyer, who met Wilson in 1980 when she was just beginning her career as a network correspondent. "He was just untamed," she recalled, "tall and gangly and wild, like a kid before they discovered Ritalin. He had this ungoverned enthusiasm, and it extended to women and the world." The congressman was like no one Sawyer had met in Washington. He was simply outrageous. Sawyer recalled the experience of driving with Charlie in his big old Continental on one of their few dinner dates. "Going down Connecticut Avenue with him, I felt as if we could have been driving into any American graffiti hamburger place." When Wilson was first elected to Congress, he'd persuaded a distinguished college professor, Charles Simpson, to leave academia and sign on as his administrative assistant. Simpson says Wilson was the brightest person he's ever worked with. "He had an uncanny ability to take a complex issue, break it down, get all the bullshit out, and deliver the heart of it. There's no question he could have been anything he wanted to be. His goal was to become Secretary of Defense. Certainly, he intended to run for the Senate." But Simpson gradually came to believe that his boss had a fatal flaw. That failing was perfectly summed up in a fitness report written by Wilson's commanding officer in the Navy in the late 1950s. "Charlie Wilson is the best officer who ever served under me at sea, and undoubtedly the worst in port." There was little question in Simpson's mind in those days that his boss had a drinking problem. As with many alcoholics, it was not immediately noticeable. Wilson had an uncanny ability to consume enormous quantities of scotch and seem unaffected. Also, he was a happy drunk who told wonderful stories and made everyone laugh. On the occasions when drinking would get to him, Simpson says, "Wilson would simply lie down on the floor for an hour, wake up, and act as if he had just had 12 hours of sleep. It was the most unreal thing I'd ever seen. He'd do this at his own parties, just sleep for an hour with everything going on around him, then get up and start again." Most of the 435 members of Congress lead surprisingly anonymous lives in Washington. They are, of course, celebrities of sorts in their own districts, but the reality of life in the Capitol is that all but a few will leave Washington without much of anyone knowing they had been there. Wilson, in contrast, had begun to attract a great deal of media attention by the early 1980s, albeit the kind that any other politician would have considered the kiss of death. The gossip columnists called him Good Time Charlie, and they had a good time themselves describing the parade of beauty queens he escorted to White House receptions and fancy embassy parties. One Texas newspaper called him the biggest playboy in Congress. The Washington Post featured a picture of Wilson and House Majority Leader Jim Wright saddled up on white horses, riding down Pennsylvania Avenue to a nightclub Wilson had just invested in. The Dallas Morning News observed that there were more congressmen on the floor of Wilson's disco, Elan, a club for the dashing was its motto, than you were ever likely to find on the floors of Congress. When challenged about his lifestyle, Wilson replied good-naturedly, "Why should I go around looking like a constipated hound dog? I'm having the time of my life." In truth, at age 47, in his fourth term in office, Charlie Wilson was completely lost. Public officials are forever doing stupid things, but they don't step into hot tubs with naked women and cocaine unless they are driven to play Russian roulette with their careers. And it was hard not to conclude that this recently divorced congressman was a man in free fall, programmed for disaster. Wilson himself would later say, "I was caught up in the longest midlife crisis in history. I wasn't hurting anybody, but I sure was aimless." If Charlie Wilson's midlife crisis had thrown him off course, it was nothing compared to the crisis America was going through. The night Wilson checked into Caesar's Palace, Ted Koppel had opened his Nightline broadcast with a disturbing refrain. Good evening. Tonight is the 237th night of captivity for the hostages in Tehran. The United States, with its $200 billion annual defense budget, couldn't even force a taunting third world nation to turn over 50 hostages. And then, when it finally screwed up its courage to mount a rescue mission, the whole world watched the humiliating spectacle of Desert One as a U.S. helicopter pilot lost his vision in a blinding dust cloud and rammed into a parked plane, leaving 8 soldiers dead and the rescue mission aborted. Over and over again it was said that Vietnam syndrome had infected the spirit of America, and by the summer of 1980 a growing number of conservatives, led by Ronald Reagan, had begun to warn that the Soviet Union might have achieved nuclear superiority, that a window of opportunity had opened in which the Soviets could launch and win a nuclear war. Other voices added to the unease, claiming that the KGB had infiltrated most Western intelligence services and that they were mounting devastatingly effective disinformation campaigns which were blinding America to the danger it faced. To the president at the time, Jimmy Carter, this kind of extreme worst-case thinking had created what he called America's paranoid fear of communism. A born-again Christian, a one-time peanut farmer and former governor of Georgia, Carter had almost no experience in foreign affairs when he ran for president, but he had won over an American public still traumatized by Vietnam and Watergate. The intelligence scandals in the late 1970s had only reinforced the widespread suspicion that the CIA was out of control, a virtual government within the government. Vowing never to lie to the American public and to introduce a new morality in Washington, Carter had all but promised an end to the CIA's dirty tricks. Once in office, President Carter moved to discipline the agency, coming close to suggesting that it was time to stop conducting covert operations altogether. His hand-picked CIA chief, Admiral Stansfield Turner, went a step further and with great fanfare carried out a purge of the agency's so-called rogue operatives. By the end of 1979, the new ground rules put down by the President and Congress had gone a long way toward altering the very culture of this embattled agency. Even the CIA's most daring operatives had come to dread the prospect of having their careers destroyed for carrying out missions that Congress might later deem illegal. By Christmas 1979, the CIA's Directorate of Operations had voluntarily all but taken itself out of the dirty tricks business. What none of the CIA's leaders could have foreseen was that Jimmy Carter, the president who had gone to such lengths to tame them, was about to be reborn as a Cold War hawk. To say that Jimmy Carter was surprised by the Soviets' Christmas invasion of Afghanistan would be a gross understatement. It radicalized him. It made him suddenly believe that the Soviets might be truly evil, and that the only way to deal with them was with force. I don't know if fear is the right word to describe our reaction, recalls Carter's Vice President Walter Mondale. But what unnerved everyone was the suspicion that Soviet President Brezhnev's inner circle might not be rational. They must have known the invasion would poison everything dealing with the West, from SALT to the deployment of nuclear weapons in Western Europe. Declaring Afghanistan the greatest foreign policy crisis confronting the United States since World War II, Carter ordered a boycott of the Olympics scheduled for Moscow that summer. He embargoed grain sales to the Soviets and called for a massive defense buildup, including the creation of a rapid deployment force. Reflecting fears about further Russian aggression, he unveiled the Carter Doctrine, committing America to war in the event of any threat to the strategic oil fields of the Middle East. His most radical departure, however, came when he signed a series of secret legal documents known as Presidential Findings, authorizing the Central Intelligence Agency to go into action against the Red Army. The CIA's time-honored practice was never to introduce into a conflict weapons that could be traced back to the United States. And so the spy agency's first shipment to the scattered Afghan rebels, enough small arms and ammunition to equip 10,000 men, consisted of weapons made by the Soviets themselves that had been stockpiled by the CIA for just such a moment. Within days of the invasion, containers from a secretive San Antonio facility were flown to Islamabad, Pakistan, where they were turned over to President Mohammad Zia-ul-Haq's intelligence service for distribution to the Afghan rebels. It hadn't been easy for Carter to get Zia to cooperate. Carter had targeted Zia, along with Anastasio Tacho Somoza of Nicaragua, in his high-profile human rights campaign, and had cut off all U.S. aid to and military cooperation with Pakistan. Now, with the Red Army sweeping into Afghanistan, Carter had to do a 180-degree turn to win Zia's approval to use Pakistan as a base of his operations. Zia drove a hard bargain. The CIA would provide the weapons, but they would have to hand them over to his intelligence service for distribution. America's spies would have to operate exclusively through Zia's men.